You are listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of August 23rd, 2021, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Irene, 10 years later. Schools reopening. Dorset approves town hall bond. And Rural America, Part 2.
It was a Sunday morning, August 28th, 2011, when Tropical Storm Irene announced its arrival with a steady downpour of rain. The forecast had called for high winds, but that wasn't the main impact the storm presented. Rather, it was the rain, 11 inches all told, that wreaked havoc across much of the state. The swath of destruction was large. The storm destroyed nearly $700 million in property, a figure that was equal to almost two-thirds of that year's state general fund budget. It damaged 200 bridges, 450 utility poles, 600 historic buildings, 1,000 culverts, 2,400 road segments, 3,500 homes, and 20,000 acres of farmland. Locally, a lot of the damage took place to roads and places around Manchester, Arlington, and East Dorset. In Sunderland, Kelly Stand Road was washed out and closed for quite a while afterwards. In Arlington, the rec park flooded. Route 7A was closed in a couple of places. Routeville and Richville roads in Manchester and the area around the Chanticleer restaurant in East Dorset were also places where extensive flooding occurred. And worse, of course, it took the lives of 7 Vermonters. With the 10th anniversary of the storm now just behind us, we talked with 3 local leaders who were at the forefront of coping with the storm and its aftermath. We started with John O'Keefe, who then as now was the town manager of Manchester, and pulled together a response team to manage the event.
You know, I guess the reflection on that is actually I felt like we were looking at the storm as a real potential threat. It was also the first time that we had activated our Emergency Operations Center. Albeit, you know, we have a fancy new one that's a sort of a state-of-the-art separate room. We were in the corner of the fire department breakfast room, and it was really tough. We were using the Emergency Operations Center to sort of break down all the damage that was happening, and it was a critical decision. But on the other side of the room were people coming in and out of the emergency. You know, people had just evacuated Billy Brownlee and his family in the bucket of an excavator. They were all geared up and all excited about the emergency. And then over here was this group of people that were supposed to think things through. And it was kind of a clash of, you know, people that were supposed to really stay focused and think things through. And then the people over here that were actually doing all the work. And it was really, it didn't work very well. It worked fine. The one thing about the Emergency Operations Center was that was the one that actually, that group, which was Jim Baker, Mike Hall, me, Lee Crone, we had figured out that the town's water system had gotten compromised really quickly by analyzing all the data that was coming into us. And that's when we put a water boil order that we put in place very, very quickly. And I think that was probably the first big success of the Emergency Operations Center was the fact that we were able to figure that out early on.
Then we met up with Philip Grubb Bourne, who was the chief of the Manchester Fire Department at the time, and asked him what his main memories of the storm were.
Well, we decided, John O'Keefe and Jim Baker was the interim chief and Mike Hall. We decided to meet here on that Sunday morning at like 10 o'clock. And things didn't look well, so I took a ride over here and I was here like at 8 o'clock and dispatch called me and said, water's rising on Bourne Brook. So I took a ride down there and I drive up the first entrance to Valley Pass up towards Debbie Hayes's house. And all of a sudden the river breaches the bank and I'm looking at a wall of water coming straight at me down the Valley Pass Road. I throw it in reverse, I back out of there. The rocks are banging on the bottom of the truck. I'm going, wow. I get out into Richville Road, pull up, and it was just a wall of water coming down Bourne Brook. And I got on the radio and said, you know, tone everybody out. And it was like all hell just broke loose all at once. And the funny part was it wasn't really raining down here. It was like, you know, not raining hard. And we got back here, and then, of course, it just, the water was all coming down into the valley, and then it breached it up behind Wallace Computer and went down behind there, and it broke the water main down behind Wallace Computer, which was a, I think, 12-inch water main. And when it broke that, it emptied the water tank up on East Mountain. And we couldn't really, didn't understand where all the water was coming. Well, it bored a hole right through Hayes's pit. And then it plugged the culvert up on Rootville Road. And so all the water was coming down Rootville Road. And in front of Joan Rizzio's house, it was probably 15 feet deep, and it took the water main out up there also, and the water was, all the water was out of the water tower. And it was just, I mean, and it just, it happened so fast, and it was raining on the mountains. And of course, we live in a valley, and all the rain came from the mountains down, and when it hit here in the valley, I mean, it washed out Richfield Road. It just took, you know, parts of the road out everywhere. Everybody stepped up to the plate. I mean, we had Dorset's trucks down here because Dorset didn't get hit as bad. East Dorset did. But everybody, and, you know, we had many meetings afterwards to kind of brainstorm what we'd do again and get everybody on board if we needed help, or Dorset needs help, East Dorset, Arlington, and got everybody on board if it happened again. I mean, this last storm was close, but it wasn't half as bad as Irene was.
Afterwards, we met up with Keith Squires of Arlington, who was the chairman of the Arlington Select Board then, and asked him to reflect back on the events of that time.
Yeah, I think the first thing was driving over here and the water was over top of the fences around the ball field. I think that was the first impression that we got a problem. And then it sort of went from there. I think everybody kind of found out about it about the same time, and we just started. We had the highway crew in and started assessing what needed to be done, and obviously the park was simply a wait for the water to go down thing. So the roads and bridges became the priority, and that's where we went. All the bridges were pretty well washed out on 313, and that was the priority, was to get those back together. So that's what we worked on for the next few days. I think when we were down at the other end of the park on 313, and the water was up high enough so it was starting to rattle that bridge on State 313, that's when I started to think that, you know, this is going to be bad, no question about it. And we sort of went from there, closed the bridge down and stopped traffic, and that was probably when it really hit me that we're in trouble. We looked at the bridges on 313, and the last bridge down, the Holly Bridge, was the one that had the least damage, and that's where we started in order to, so we could get traffic back across over onto the other side. The Woodard Bridge was still passable with a car, so we let people go back and forth on that for a day and a half, and then got Holly Bridge temporarily fixed up, and then came up and started working on River Road on this end to get the rest of the bridges open.
Tropical Storm Irene remains the biggest and most damaging storm to have hit our area over the past decade, but with growing evidence that climate change may prompt more frequent and more intense storms and unpredictable weather, it may be the sort of experience we might see again. Improvements like better culverts might seem unsensational, but likely will seem well worth it. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Not all that long ago, school officials locally and across Vermont were looking forward to a reopening of schools this fall in a much more normal fashion than was the case a year ago. But the emergence of the Delta variant of the COVID-19 virus has upended at least parts of that hoped-for outcome. With case counts on the rise again, school officials are trying to balance rules around face masks, vaccines, safety, and getting the educational process going again. The state's Agency of Education has issued a 2-page guidance document, but it is not mandatory, and local school boards and districts have leeway on how they wish to implement it. It calls for students and staff returning to school when indoors to wear face masks for the first 10 instructional days of the coming school year, until the vaccination rate among students is at least equal to 80% of the school's population eligible for a vaccine. After that, masks would no longer be required for those eligible for vaccination, meaning students 12 years old and older. The Agency of Education is making recommendations, not regulations, as Education Secretary Daniel French told us in a recent conversation.
We're pretty confident that a state of emergency is not going to be necessary this year to manage the pandemic in schools and otherwise in our society. And that's an important distinction from last year, because under a state of emergency and under the governor's emergency order, as secretary, I was delegated specific authority, as was Commissioner Levine, to operate some institutions, including schools, in a manner to ensure the broader public safety. That's not the context we're in now. So what that means at the local level is that the state, and largely Commissioner Levine and I, what we did last Thursday is we're publishing recommendations for schools to follow. That's different than last year when we were publishing essentially regulatory guidance that was mandatory. So we're doing our best to parse through the information as we've always done and to have that be informed by the practical operational variety of our school system. And to provide recommendations. And I think that would be challenging in itself for folks to wrap their heads around. But of course, now we have the Delta variant, which is very challenging, I think, to any decision making. So we're, you know, at this point, recommending that all schools open with everyone wearing masks. And then, you know, we're really trying to leverage our high vaccination rate. And that's been a challenging point for us because a lot of the national guidance, which came out towards the end of July, beginning of August, because there are many school systems in the country that open in August, early August, you know, those guidance documents, both from the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics, were, from our perspective, sort of generic and very general, and not that didn't really seem to acknowledge that New England states and Vermont in particular have exceedingly high vaccination rates. So that was sort of our first challenge in our decision making. And then secondly, the fact that we have a large number of our students who are vaccinated within that high vaccination rate, and it's really the 12 and under that are a concern. We are making an effort to, you know, this month to really push out vaccination clinics for all those that are currently eligible for vaccination. But to not draw some distinction between high schools, for example, where there's a very high level of vaccination in Vermont versus our elementary schools, where there's still a large number of students who aren't even eligible for vaccination, I think was an important distinction for us. So what we're recommending is we start everyone with 2 weeks with required masks, but then we are recommending that folks start to parse out a little bit what they do next based on the relative vaccination rates of those that are in their buildings that are eligible for vaccination.
Meanwhile, local school leaders are trying to move forward around the once again concerning safety issues while gearing up for a full-blown return to in-person learning. Depending on the grade levels being taught in various schools, that presents different issues. Randy Lowe, the superintendent of the Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union, oversees six elementary and middle schools.
We have decided to open the year until further notice, having everyone wearing masks in our schools. Because we don't offer a high school, we have all of our schools are either through fifth grade, sixth grade, or eighth grade. So we don't find ourselves in a position in which 80% of the population, the student population, would be eligible for the vaccine or vaccinated. Given conditions right now with the Delta variant, I chose to say we're all wearing masks at this point. I think it's the safest and best way for me to ensure that we have conditions to to provide a continuous educational experience for our kids. So we will definitely be wearing masks beyond the first 10 days of school. Our students won't have the opportunity to be vaccinated until something's approved. There's discussion that may be in October, but who knows? So if that's the case, then, you know, we're looking at the two dose regimen followed by another 2 weeks. So I expect it to be quite some time before, unless things change, unless the guidance change and conditions change, given where we are right now, I expect us to be in masks for quite some time.
Mark Tashin, the headmaster at Burn Burton Academy, described their approach and their plans for reopening school.
The guidance from the Agency of Education is that the entire school community should be masked for the first 10 days. That's what we plan on doing. We are now in the process of gathering vaccination data. And if we are above 80% vaccination rate, and I expect us to be above 80%, then the guidance calls for no restrictions, and we plan to follow that guidance. We are obviously going to be monitoring a variety of factors as we go, and if need be, we would, you know, I could see asking people to wear masks or requiring people to wear masks for some limited period of time based on local conditions or specific in-school conditions. But in general, my sincere hope is that we can be an island in the Delta storm and largely escape it. But hope is not the only strategy. I mean, hope and vaccination and constant vigilance, I think, is what will get us there.
In Arlington, which is now part of the Southwest Vermont Supervisory Union, the school board held a lengthy discussion about the Agency of Education's guidance, and especially the piece around face masks, before deciding to follow it for the first 10 days of school on a 3-2 vote by the board. The school board will likely revisit the question at its next meeting on September 8th. William Basic, now an assistant superintendent as the Arlington and Sandgate school districts transition into the SVSU, described the plans for reopening schools in Arlington.
We're going to follow the AOE guidance. The board supported it on a 3-2 vote. To be honest, though, and kind of in defense of the board, it wasn't that they were anti-wearing the masks. They were kind of very confused about the guidance and thought it was ambiguous in a lot of ways. So one of the things they wanted to do was have a lot of questions answered about the guidance. So the 3-2 vote was close, but it wasn't because they were not anticipating the children wearing the mask. Again, I think it was around the clarity of the language.
So the plan then at this point then is to ask students, and I'm assuming from pre-K through 12th grade, when they come to school, return to school in the, to be wearing masks?
Yeah, we actually start in 2 days. We are one of the earliest starting districts. We start August 25th, so our teachers are back today. Yes, they will be wearing masks in school. We won't be wearing them outside, which is good. There's another school board meeting on September 8th, specifically around the AOE guidance. We anticipate things changing. As we know, the guidance was put out around August 4th, which is a little bit late to start out with. But, the Delta variant has really begun surging within our area here. We are seeing some cases around town, which we did not all summer. We were able to run 120 staff and students in our elementary school with no masks throughout the whole summer. Not the whole summer, but for 5 weeks, and we did not have any cases or any scares. So, we are expecting probably a case or two within the first couple weeks because they're naturally coming up in Bennington County. So we're going to have to be ready.
And meanwhile, up at the Long Trail School in Dorset, which teaches students from grades 6 through 12, Seth Linfield, their head of school, told us about their plans.
We opened with our all-time record enrollment of 240 students. We are masking through Labor Day, whether everyone needs to mask, whether vaccinated or not, and then we will reassess where we are at Labor Day, and we really are continuously analyzing and evaluating from a health and safety perspective. We do require a form, whether vaccinated or not. This allows us to monitor what percentage of our eligible students are vaccinated.
All told, it's a more complicated picture than seemed likely back earlier this summer, when vaccines seem to have had the COVID-19 virus on the run. But it's also a fluid one, and subject to change depending on how the Delta variant plays out. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Voters in Dorset approved a bond for $3.6 million during voting at the town office on Tuesday, August 24th, to construct a new town office building to be located on Raptor Lane, off of Route 30. The bond was approved by a 177-126 margin in a relatively light turnout of voters, which saw about 20% of eligible voters casting ballots. The new proposed town hall building would offer more meeting space, more office space for the town staff, more vault space for town records, and would be fully handicapped accessible. It would also be, according to its design, an environmentally friendly carbon-neutral building, located on the south side of Raptor Lane, on town-owned property that's part of a 370-acre lot that the town was able to purchase for a bargain price of about $100,000 3 years ago, adjacent to the Owl's Head Town Forest. Now it's on to the permitting process, which town manager Rob Giotti estimated could take 8 to 12 months to complete, between obtaining local and state Act 250 permits.
So there's a bit of a few-week process to where the bond gets certified, and the vote gets certified, rather. And basically kind of during that time, we'll have the design group meet to lay out kind of a timeline and the next steps. Really the next items that need to be dealt with is permitting. We have to get both state and local permits for the project. Everything from we've an Act 250 permit at the state level to amending the stormwater permit for the property on the local side, we'll have to go through site development plan review and all that stuff. And the consultants are telling me that's probably an 8 to 12 month process. Also included in that is site type permits, which are, you know, water, wastewater permitting and sleuthing around. We'll have to do that, during that kind of same time frame, the permitting process. So that's a little and there's some time, there's some fairly significant time devoted to that. That was one of the reasons why the timing of the vote was structured the way it was. The interest rate that we had used in the estimate for the bond bank for the vote was around 2.9%. Right now, there's some good news that the interest rates at the bond bank are closer to 2.2. So we're hopeful that'll hold steady. In addition to, when we did the estimates for the materials related to the project, it was February of this year, of 21. And a lot of some of the lumber prices and stuff like that have gone down since then. So we're hopeful that we'll see some reductions in some of the ancillary items. But there's a process to go through with permitting, and that'll take up, the next 8 to 12 months.
If all goes according to plan and the permits are approved, ground could be broken for the new building by the fall of next year or by the spring of 2023. The hope is to have the new building constructed and ready for occupancy by the end of 2023, or if not, by the spring of 2024. Meanwhile, the town is also exploring what new purpose to put the current town hall building, located on Mayatom Road in East Dorset, to. Town Manager Giotti told us.
One of the things that will happen kind of in concert with the permitting process is that, we'll start to try to engage the community about the East Dorset site and what our neighbors and the people in the village would like to see at the East Dorset site. And I think that, we've been fortunate enough that, there are some community members that want to help us with that process in terms of potentially underwriting some of the costs to look at, options. Which is great. I think it's it'll be a good process. We hope to get as much input from the folks in East Dorset as we can, because if they want this, generally, I think the feedback that we've gotten is that the site should remain public, There is a deed restriction on part of the property here at Mad Tom that does require it to be public. So we want to make sure that if we turn it into green space, it's got the type of resources and assets that people want.
For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. In the first part of this two-part series on the future of rural America and rural Vermont, we heard from two leading thinkers on the subject, Matt Dunn, the executive director of the Center on Rural Innovation, a nonprofit organization based in Heartland, Vermont, and Paul Costello, the executive director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Rural America has been in a long-term relative decline compared with urban areas in the nation, at least when examined in terms of population growth and economic activity. While it could be argued that this is simply one more chapter in a long-term up-and-down cycle, economic and technological factors seem to show little sign of reversing in the near future, leading many to conclude a continuing hollowing out of rural parts of the nation is likely to continue. The recently released U.S. Census statistics would seem to bear this out. From 2010 to 2020, metropolitan areas grew by 9%, compared with only 1% growth for smaller areas. Less than half of the nation's 3,143 counties saw any population increases over the past decade, while 81% of metropolitan areas grew, according to the census data. Will the pandemic change this dynamic? Possibly, as perceptions about quality of life and, potentially, job opportunities lure present-day city dwellers drawn by the diversity and quality of life experiences of urban areas to smaller towns and rural areas. In Vermont, we've all seen properties snapped up rapidly, and some towns, especially resort-based communities like Windhall and Dover, growing rapidly in population. Whether that is a long-term trend remains to be seen. Here to continue our conversation about this and related aspects of it are Peter Radford, an economist and co-founder of the World Economics Association. We were also pleased to be joined by Jesse Piles, the executive director of Smoky House in Danby and a native of West Virginia, a state which has seen its fortunes rise and fall with the coal and natural resource extraction industries. Together, Peter and Jesse will give us their take on where rural areas may be headed. We began by having Peter Radford trace the progression of how our present state of affairs grew out of long-term historical forces.
The agricultural parts of the United States, the rural parts of the United States, Vermont obviously reflecting that, have been enormously successful in being productive, which meant that you need far fewer people living in these places to produce the same amount of stuff. And that's historic. I mean, that goes back 100 years. Then you have a lot of those people siphoned off into the industrial world. And now you've got not just the rural world, but that Rust Belt, that industrial world, now facing the next wave of technology and innovation, which, of course, is, whatever you want to call it, the digital world, the computer world, the world of artificial intelligence, all of those kinds of things. So the economy is being rebuilt. And at any moment when you've got these fundamental reconstructions going on, you've got some of these older tensions resurface in different ways. And I think that's what part of Vermont's problem. Vermont was never, for instance, rewired to become part of this new economy. It doesn't have any of the centers of innovation. It doesn't have a Silicon Valley. It doesn't have Route 128 around Boston. Which is where the action was taking place back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, as this thing began to build steam. So there is that feeling that there's been an underinvestment in not just in Vermont, but in rural areas generally. They did their job. They produced the food supply. And then they became enormously efficient. I go back. I mentioned to you before we started talking about my sister, my daughter living sister, my daughter living in Nebraska. They there's the two of them. They farm thousands of acres, with computer-driven machinery, GPS. That the thing can almost do it itself. They have the satellite turning on the water supply. That's enormous productivity gain. But the flip side is you don't need as many people living in those kinds of parts of the world. So there's a natural expulsion, if you like, a desire to move out of those. And at one point we hit, as you go back to your point, we hit a sort of a peak maybe in the early post-World War II era where we had this pull into the cities. We had the suburb being built because of all the road construction and the infrastructure investment made life very easy. Rural areas weren't part of that process. Now we're living through another similar process where there's an even greater pull into the cities because of the research, the interaction, which is kind of ironic because when we all started talking about the internet a few decades ago, we all thought it was going to spread the world around. Communication, you know, the earth is flat. The end, what was it? Ken Cross's book, The Death of Distance. Right, but it's done the exact opposite. it's created pockets where people can go talk to each other, invent new things, and that proximity really, really matters to them. So we've got this growth taking place now. Whether the key question I think you're asking is that permanent?
Yeah.
Or do we start to see a flow back out after that? And I think that really hinges on the way in which the small towns in the rural areas develop themselves. If you have the right infrastructure, I think you can become a very, very attractive, dispersed, decentralized, you can create a very good way of life for people. But that infrastructure has to be put there. You need competitive broadband. You need the housing. You need the schools. You need the access. Down here in Southern Vermont, I mean, it's difficult to get to. We have no train. We have no high speed anything. The roads are pretty obscure. Some people disappear to the hills because they like that. But if you're trying to position for the future and attract a younger population that then becomes a sustaining population, you may have to deal with things like that. And we've postponed a lot of that investment. Or that investment just hasn't taken place, I should say. We shouldn't say it's postponed. It just hasn't taken place. So the critical point there is, can we use the technology to decentralize, to move out again? It's certainly amenable to that. Whether we can do it or not, I think comes down to local initiative. Whether there's a sufficient, hesitate to use the phrase, but public-private effort to combine resources and create initiatives to attract people back. I mean, there's a lot of young people in this era, I think, would love a very nice lifestyle. Southern Vermont has that in spades. Is it accessible? Is it amenable? Can you build that future? And I think the answer is yes, if you have that infrastructure. If you don't have that infrastructure, you don't do it. And the urban areas were the first areas, don't forget, where that digital infrastructure was put in place because of the density of population. And there's very little private profit-making incentive to put that same infrastructure in a low-density place, which requires you culturally to cross the boundary and say, well, there's got to be some public effort involved. And that's a big political cultural step to take. And I, you know, that's something we can watch.
As we're seeing now with the infrastructure bill or
yes,
the jobs
yes.
bill. I mean,
that's a fascinating point. Fascinating point. It is a great opportunity if it's seized for the right purpose.
What do you make of the sense, or do you feel like there's also a cultural kind of cleavage between the rural and urban areas? I mean, it's easy to kind of generalize around that and say, oh yeah, well, urban areas are filled with blue voters and rural areas are filled with, you know, conservative red voters or whatever. Is that like too facile a generalization, do you think?
or is there something to it where the nature of rural life nowadays sort of leads people into more of a, you know, individually based self-help. I'm on my own. I can take care of myself, or I hope my neighbors, help me. And, but the big bad state can kind of, you know, stay at a bit of a remove.
Well, think back to the history of the United States again. I mean, if you look at the progressive era, there was certainly a lot of pretty progressive action out in what we would now regard as the Midwest and some of the, I mean, if you think of the centers of some of the agitation, you can think of Ohio, Wisconsin. There was a lot of activity that nowadays we would call very progressive. Right, but starting out in the rural areas, so I don't think it's an inevitable that that kind of political divide, if you like, exists urban rural. I think it's more to do with the evolution of the political parties themselves. I think that they've almost have defined some of this. You look at our own circumstances in Vermont. I mean, a lot of people who call themselves Republicans in Vermont would not necessarily be Republican at the national level. So imprinting a national kind of separation at the local level can be a little misleading, I think. Compare in my family circumstances, compare Vermont and Nebraska, right? Okay. On the current political map, they look very different. But if you talk to people in both those states, the issues are very similar. So why are they politically very different? And, are they responding simply to the direction that the national political parties have taken? And is that necessarily therefore a reflection of activity at the local level or requirements at the local level? I think in other words, I suppose I'm saying that the rural urban divide in politics is not as hard set as a lot of people look on the surface and think it is. I think it can flip back and forth quite easily, depending on the attitudes and natures and the responsiveness of the parties themselves. Rural people like to think of themselves as being a little more self-sufficient, independent, and so forth. So maybe they have a little bit of a hostility to socialize something or other. But then I look, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you look back to the late 1800s and early 1900s, the progressive era. There was a lot of socialist talk out in rural Ohio, rural Midwest. So these are not hard and fast separations. They evolve and ebb and flow, I think, in response to, I think, the perception of national politics. Are we being paid attention to? I think if there's one thing that I would argue, and this is politics, I mean, one thing I would argue at the national level is that a lot of parts of the country don't feel like they've been part of that conversation, the national conversation. And I think both political parties are part of that, so that's just my own opinion. But I think that there hasn't been as much response to local issues as there could have been. And I think that's exaggerated the divide depending on where you are. I mean, I think if you're in an inner city, you may feel the same sort of alienation as if you're in rural Vermont. You just respond to it differently in which team you decide to support. But if you get everyone in the same room, you may say, wow, hang on a minute. Yes, we've got very similar issues, don't we? I think that divide, that political divide, whilst it looks really sharp, is a lot more fungible, easily moved, easily changed than it appears to be.
And now we turn to Jesse Piles, the executive director of Smoky House in Danby, for his observations.
What perplexes me is that West Virginia and Appalachia more broadly has such a history of like corporate robber barons from away. I don't understand. I can't answer your question, I guess, but I don't understand how we've been fleeced, we West Virginians, by this promise of upward mobility or opportunity from corporate coal barons or from, you know, steel industry magnates who are going to like somehow save us with more jobs in the Ohio River Valley or in Mingo County, West Virginia or something. I don't know why, but I get the sense that we lost our strong labor union underpinnings and instead started blaming big government for regulations that were keeping the corporation from employing us. I also think that there's this strange phenomenon that I think is kind of cultural cull, where I think that West Virginians and other folks have taken on coal culture as such a crucial part of their identity that even though the number of people directly employed by the coal industry or indirectly advantaged by the economic activity of the coal industry have such an affinity or an identification with coal culture that they see climate regulation or labor regulation as impeding progress that would benefit them, even if it doesn't benefit them. There are so few, I mean, in recent decades, there's so few coal jobs. I mean, I can understand how it was built on the backs of labor, but the way they mine coal in southern West Virginia now is with dynamite and D9 dozers. They don't, I mean, they still send people into mines, don't get me wrong, and there are hardworking people on all aspects of, in all aspects of operating coal, but it's not big numbers. It's not a whole lot of people employed by the coal industry in southern West Virginia, and it hasn't been for years. And even more recently, if you think about the natural gas boom that came back to West Virginia and more where I grew up in the soft coal country in the northern part of the state, steel processing and natural gas booms, it's a bunch of folks who are hired from outside of the state to come in and do the work and then leave when the work's done. So there was this huge boom in my hometown of natural gas exploration, all these wells put in since 2006, 2008, that timeline roughly. And it was a whole bunch of folks from Oklahoma and Texas who were brought up in that industry out there, came back to the Ohio Valley and drilled a bunch of wells and then went home. And because of West Virginia's history of divorcing surface land rights from mineral rights underground, there are questions of land ownership and who should rightly be compensated for gas wells and gas exploration and who shouldn't. It's a huge mess. But again, we're kind of reliant on these outside industries to create economic activity when it's really not directly benefiting very many local people at all. So I feel like we have to kind of wrestle with these questions about what we value and what we consider wealth. And again, easy enough for me to say as a white guy from a perch of privilege in this place. But the truth is, if I didn't have this job here, I couldn't afford to live in this community myself. And so while I might not be able to just say, you know, what would be the kind of economic stimulus or stimulation that would make this place a thriving business economy, I can certainly say that I really value a shorter supply chain to my food. And so if we're investing in, I think it was one of the points made in that article I sent you, they phrased it as reining in big agriculture, right? Did you see this?
Yeah.
You have this 5 points. But to me, the converse to that argument is to really support small ag. And so if we can, and maybe the pandemic has really shown me this, it's like there's been, and through my work at the Hunger Councils primarily, there's been a real diffusion of responsibility for addressing food insecurity in this community. And you might say, oh, well, the food bank did all this stuff. Well, the food bank did some great things over this past year, but so did school janitors who are driving food the last mile to kids who couldn't reach the school to get their meals, or the church basement that suddenly turned into a food pantry, or the new farm stand that decided to divert some of their funds to a vegetable share for somebody in their community. Or there's just been so many demonstrations of this diffusion of responsibility for taking care of each other through this. And I think if we can value that more fully, if we can create the kind of social connections that allow us to respond to folks in need when they are in need, that we'll have stronger communities. We'll have people meeting basic needs well enough that they can then start to get creative about how to provide for themselves and their families.
The future fortunes of rural states have a large political dimension as well. Sooner or later, smaller populations will eventually equate with diminished political clout. And there are broad cultural issues and questions that may come into play as well. Looking ahead, this may well prompt another installment on the series, since Vermont, in its own way, is mirroring some of these broader trends. Burlington and Chittenden County grew spectacularly over the past 10 years, as did several other communities, while others stayed stuck in neutral or saw populations decline. What do you think about this whole urban-rural divide question? We'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts to offer, send an email to andrew@gnat-tv.org, and we'll be interested to read what you have to say. For now, for the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.